Welcome to another edition of Mormon Land. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce, and I oversee our faith coverage. I'm joined again by senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher-Stack.
Hi, Dave.
Good to see you. Perhaps no issues have roiled members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints more than questions of race, gender, and sexuality. Scholar Taylor Petrie offers an original exploration of these topics and how they connect and intersect in his new book, Tabernacles of Clay, Sexuality and Gender in Modern Mormonism. Petrie, the current editor of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, and an associate professor of religion at Kalamazoo College, joins us today via Zoom. Taylor, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here with both of you.
We're really happy to have you. So, Taylor, why write this book?
Oh, good question. I kept waiting for somebody else to write it, and nobody else did, so then I felt I had to. I've spent my career working in religion and gender and sexuality, and kept thinking somebody who works on Mormon studies has got to write a good history of gender and sexuality, and sort of was twiddling my thumbs, looking around, and realized, oh, I guess that's me. And I decided to apply for a fellowship and accidentally won it. And then I had to write it after that. So that's how it came about.
So, Taylor, what was your kind of hypothesis going in? And what did you ultimately kind of conclude, I guess? At least in a kind of a brief form.
Yeah, I started the project thinking that I would write a history of from the beginnings of the church, from Joseph Smith up through polygamy, the end of polygamy, up through the modern era, and started off doing that research. But as I was getting into it, I was finding that the questions that I thought were the most important ended up kind of showing up more and more in the period since World War II. And as I realized that the doctrines that the church teaches now about gender, sexuality, and marriage were not actually established in the early 1900s, but really in the 1960s and 70s, that became really the kind of pressure period that I decided I needed to focus on and needed to tell that story. So as the research evolved, I ended up focusing more on what I call the modern period. But the idea then was to sort of show the ways in which the current teachings of the church around heterosexuality, around sexual difference in terms of the male and female, there being a sort of essential difference between the two of those, were not actually long-standing teachings of the church, but actually much more recent developments.
So speaking of that, Taylor, you know, in the 1995 Proclamation on the Family, it says that the gender is eternal. And what did they teach before that? I know that when I was reporting on that, I hadn't really heard that term before. What did they teach before that? And what difference does it make?
Yeah. That document, it doesn't totally come out of nowhere in 1995. It really is in the 70s and 80s that those ideas kind of crystallize a little bit more. But before that, you've got teachings in General Conference, BYU professors and so on, saying that you might not have gender in the afterlife. You might die, and if you're not resurrected to the celestial state, then you're going to be neither male nor female. And they're quoting scriptures as evidence of that. And they're saying all the other Christians are right, that there is no male and female, except for those in the celestial kingdom. And they even suggested that before one was born, that we might have actually chosen which gender we were going to be. And they used a lot of the same doctrines that were emerging around issues of race in the 1950s and 60s to say, you know, you chose the decisions that you made in the premortal existence determined the conditions that you were born in this life, including race and including whether you were male or female. And so it was actually a choice that somebody made in the pre-existence rather than an eternal characteristic. So you see those doctrines sort of wane a little bit in the 80s, and they're officially rebuked in the 1980s. And then in the 1990s, we see the Proclamation on the Family sort of establishing this new eternal gender doctrine.
What wasn't there a time when there was something called intelligences that were before spirits and they were not gendered?
So this is an open issue in Mormon thought during this period as well, is whether or not the sort of stage before one is a spirit child of God, that in that stage of what is called an intelligence, this is really deep stuff here, okay, but there's some pre-existence. And the pre-existence, is there gender or not? And what does it even mean to say that there is sexual difference? You know, these are presumably unembodied beings of some sort, intelligences. Does it, you know, do they have penises? Do they have, what is it that would even make them gendered if they were? And so that's another open question that sort of is trying to get resolved in this period. I think is actually still an open question, isn't resolved in Mormon thought today. But that there was a period in which Mormons believed that there was no gender to the individual soul, to the individual spirit, to the individual intelligence before a certain period, even in the premortal existence.
Hey, Taylor, how did the conversation about the proclamation and that statement, gender is eternal, kind of change or morph with Dallin Oaks' talk in a recent general conference?
Yeah, so Oaks has made a really interesting interpretation, and one that I'm still trying to untangle a little bit, where he says that the doctrine of gender as being eternal actually refers to biological sex. Well, and there's an interesting question. Why didn't they just put biological sex in the document to begin with, if that's what they meant by it? Because everybody in the 1990s knew exactly what gender meant, that it referred to gender roles. And the document itself refers to gender roles. It says that there are eternal purposes, and then it explains here are the roles of women they're supposed to nurture, and here are the roles of men they're supposed to provide. I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say that it only means biological sex, even in the document itself, because it suggests all of these other things that then are supposedly flowing from that. So even if it did mean sex, and even if the document actually does refer to biological sex, and he was around when it was drafted, so we have to take his word for it. It certainly isn't exclusive of biological sex as being the only thing that it refers to. It definitely includes the other distinctions around what we would call gender roles.
So there's this place in the book where you talk about sexual fluidity and then sexual malleability, and those being two different things. The sexual fluidity coming from a secular scholar, but then grabbed onto by some religious scholars, including LDS, who say, oh, if sexuality is fluid, then we ought to be able to change. Tell me what the difference is between those two things.
Yeah, this is a really good question. And this is where I'm really trying to make, I think, a novel contribution to the ways that Latter-day Saints have understood the history of our own teachings around this, because I try to situate them in broader psychological discussions about the nature of gender and sexuality that are going on in the 20th century. They go all the way back to psychoanalysis and, you know, early 20th century thought too. But when church leaders start to think about what they see as the threats to gender and sexuality in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, they really latch on to the kind of language that already exists in the psychological literature and that is also being adopted by other Christian groups as well. They're doing the exact same thing that we are, is they're sort of latching on to this these psychological terms to understand it. And so when they start to think about the threats to gender and sexuality, they say, well, if there are threats that can undo patriarchy, that can undo the hierarchies between male and female and blur the differences between the two, then certainly there are actions that we can take to preserve those as well. And so they latch onto this concept of sexual malleability, where we can form and shape and mold people's sexual desires, people's gender identity, by properly teaching them from a young age all of these things. And so they institute all kinds of programs in the church to make sure that sexual difference is sort of taught and instructed. And then it goes far beyond, of course, the walls of the church, into the home, of course, but into the political sphere as well. And the church is really invested in a kind of politics that preserves sexual difference in the ways that they've come to understand it, based on this idea that sexuality is malleable, that it's at risk, and that it can also be molded and shaped in, quote unquote, the correct ways if we are smart about it, if we're strategic about it.
How is that different than sexual fluidity?
So the sexual fluidity side of the argument comes out of also out of psychological circles. It tends to be adopted today by queer theorists, by people who are maybe on the more liberal end of the spectrum. But it's rooted in the same ideas, but rather than thinking of there being a lot of agency or choice or direct control that we can have over sexuality in order to form it into heterosexual desires, sexual fluidity advocates say, listen, sexuality is fluid. It just is. Why are we trying to control it? We don't need to constrain it. We should allow it to sort of be more free and let it roam on its own. And so the people who are advocating for that, although they're both sexual malleability in the way that the church understands it as a way of controlling it and sexual fluidity as a way of letting it loose, of freedom, of liberation, they're both still rooted in the same idea of a kind of social construction of sexuality as the kind of core or root of what it's all about.
So you brought this up, much of the where the church is today kind of stems from what happened after World War II. So how has the church's view of, say, homosexuality changed since World War II?
So really, it starts with World War II. The church doesn't have a doctrine of homosexuality or have any teachings on homosexuality before World War II because they never used the term or the concept. And I need to qualify what I mean by that a little bit, because when I say that, I don't mean to suggest that there was no such thing as same-sex sexual relationships before that, or that church members, church leaders and members had never heard of them. They definitely had heard of them. They were rampant. That, you know, there's no reason to believe that they weren't just as common then as they were today. But homosexuality is a new way of thinking about sexuality and thinking about homosexual or same-sex relationships as pathological, as having a kind of mental component to them, and that mental component then needs to be cured. And so they take this language of that homosexuality is a disease and that it's a mental disorder and that it needs to be cured, and that's a new development since World War II. They had never talked in those terms before. They had never thought about it in those terms before. But they develop a whole new regime of treating homosexuality as a psychological malady that needs to be helped during this time period. And that gets you into reparative therapy and the efforts to cure that. The church has backed away a little bit, I think, in the last decade or so from those. But that's where all of that comes from, is this totally new way of thinking about what same-sex relationships are. That is kind of encapsulated in that term homosexuality, used for the first time in 1952. That's the first time church leaders ever used the term.
So, but many of the positions seem to be based more on like a cultural construct, as you said, rather than necessarily a theological examination. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, yes, in the sense that...
Is that too simplified?
I want to say that Latter-day Saints definitely are bringing their own theological concepts to new ideas like homosexuality, and have different justifications and maybe for why they would oppose it than other Christians might. But Latter-day Saints are tracking along with all other Christians during this same time period. When they embrace reparative therapy, it's the same time that all other Christians are embracing, not all Christians, but other conservative Christians are embracing reparative therapy. When they walk away from reparative therapy, it's the same time that other Christians are walking away from it. When they oppose same-sex marriage, they're opposing it at the same time and in the same ways that other Christians are. So Latter-day Saints are really belonging to a broader context of other conservative Christians who are sharing ideas. Literally, they're in the same rooms talking about these things. They belong to the same organizations. There are networks where these groups get together and discuss these things and develop the vocabulary that they're going to use. Or now we're going to start saying same-sex attraction instead of homosexuality, right? There's a network here that Latter-day Saints belong to and that we're sort of tracking along with. We rarely deviate from the larger conservative Christian take on these issues.
But now there, the LDS Church and I presume others are saying that have abandoned the sort of disease element, or have they? They're also, the LDS Church is kind of acknowledging that it's not choice, that people have certain attractions that they are born with. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely, and that really. takes off in the last decade, but I trace it back to the mid-1990s, actually to Elder Oaks giving I think he wrote an Ensign article about this called Same-Sex Attraction, where he starts to kind of hypothesize maybe for some people it is an inborn trait. And that becomes contested among church leaders. Elder Packer famously did not believe that at all. So there's this internal dispute between members of the 12 on the nature of sexuality here. But the church leaders do start to, especially in the early 2000s, start to open up to the possibility of some kinds of identity, some sorts of fixed sexual attractions as actually being something that we're not going to be able to cure. And so they do start to walk away from reparative therapy, at least in some cases. They certainly walk away from, suggesting that marriage is going to be a cure here as well. And so they start to take what I call accommodationist positions, where they're going to say, all right, we're not going to totally condemn sexuality or homosexuality in all cases. We're going to say you're allowed to say that you're gay, at least now, right? And so in 2007, the church, or BYU, changes its policy. It's a honor code and that says that faculty and students are now allowed to identify, which before they weren't. And then we see pastoral efforts like Mormon and Gay and Mormons and Gays and these works that are attempting to try to normalize and say it's okay to be out in the church. It's okay to say that you're gay in the church. It's okay to have that identity. You're loved. And there are these sort of pastoral outreach efforts that attempt to accommodate some kinds of identity. Of course, relationships are still off the table, but there is a change there as they kind of walk back the disease and cure language that they had so much embraced in the earlier era.
So I was pretty fascinated that your book starts off with a discussion of race in the church and then a lengthy examination of feminism, the Equal Rights Amendment, the church's opposition. Why tackle those three things? What did you, I think I know why, but how are these three things related?
Well, the typical way that people have approached this period of history, when it has been approached at all, and many people don't study modern Mormon history, but when it has been approached, it's been, we're either going to look at race, and race is the only category, or we're only going to look at women's history, or we're only going to look at LGBT history. And I, as a scholar of this period, as a scholar of the ways that scholars are thinking about this more and more, realize that these are not three separate conversations. They're all deeply intertwined. So I start with race really for a couple of reasons. The first is that so much of the way that church leaders were talking about segregation in the 1950s and 60s was as a concern over sexuality and marriage. And every time they say, we need to be a segregated society, and we need to get... it's because they say, if we're not, then we're going to have intermarriage. We're going to have sex between the different races, and that is a forbidden thing. And so I wanted us to really understand the history of racism in the church as being deeply entwined with the ways that we think about sexuality. And so that was a big part of it. And then the second part of it was to see the ways that that we've talked about marriage have changed over time. Who could marry who was a big question in the 1950s and 60s. And we thought we had that figured out, right? We thought, okay, people of the same race are the only people who are allowed to marry each other. And then they sort of walked that back and then they just got rid of it. And now we don't have that restriction anymore. And that wasn't even necessarily out of revelation, because they continued to teach against intermarriage after 1978. And then it just sort of went away and they don't teach that anymore. And so so I end that chapter specifically with Mia Love, for instance, the congresswoman from Utah, who was held up in the Deseret News and other outlets as this great example of a great Mormon woman. She works outside of the home. She works outside of the state even. And she's in a mixed race relationship, right? And so these become... not things that the church was really scared of as they were in an early period, because of course women working outside of the home was a huge source of controversy up through the 1980s. And the church really changes its doctrines on all of those things. And I really wanted to try to understand, how is it that the church could change its teachings on race, to change its teachings on women's roles, and end up where it is today? What were the various steps that it took along the way to get there?
So, Taylor, how does the notion of a heavenly mother play into this mix. You know, the church has affirmed that recently in an essay. How does this, what part does that play?
Great question. Great question. Not a clear one, unfortunately. I wish that there were. You know, it's been a contested point. The existence and the roles of Heavenly Mother has been in a contested point between feminists in the church and the institutional church, who have interpreted her in two very different ways. The institutional church wants to interpret her as an example of a kind of conservative femininity, someone who is more or less silent and doesn't really do much. The public roles are held for men, while, of course, LDS feminists have said, no, she's an equal partner with her husband. So you see these kind of competing ideologies of marriage as kind of manifesting in the theology here, one that kind of institutes a more patriarchal, the husband is the head of the family, and the other is the egalitarian, the one where that many Mormon feminists have affirmed that husband and wife are equal in the relationship. And so just as an example of this tension, you see it playing out even in the proclamation on the family as well, because on the one hand, it says the husband shall preside. And on the other hand, it says, husband and wife are equal partners. So you get both of these kind of competing ideas of egalitarianism and patriarchy in the same document, in part because it hasn't really been worked out in Mormon thought. We're trying to kind of hold on to both of them at the same time, and that often leads to us speaking out of both sides of the of our mouths about it too. Do we affirm one or the other? Often both, sometimes, you know, one more than the other, depending on who you're talking to and which what issue they're trying to get across.
Does the Heavenly Mother teaching complicate things for LGBTQ members?
This isn't really a part of this book, okay? But I got an answer anyway.
Take a stab.
I have written on this in the Harvard Theological Review and a few other places to try to untangle it a little bit. On the one hand, yes, because Heavenly Mother has been put forward as not just the example, as we mentioned before, of either egalitarian or patriarchal marriage, but specifically of heterosexual marriage as well. And so the way that heterosexuality becomes a part of the story of the heavens that we're supposed to then be imitating is very much the way that conservative members of the church have come to think about it. Now, again, if you go back 20 or 30 years, you don't see heterosexuality as the main point of Heavenly Mother. The main point of the Heavenly Mother teaching is patriarchy, right? So even moving from patriarchy to heterosexuality is the ways that we think about Heavenly Mother shows a shift there, right? At the same time, it's also possible, I think, to think of creative ways of solving this dilemma for LGBT people who are seeking to have marriage recognized by the church. And we can think of all kinds of other examples in the heavens. The relationship between Jehovah and Michael in the creation story, for instance, seems to be a really good example of one of these same-sex relationships that's a creative, procreative even. They're creating Michael, or I'm sorry, they're creating Adam, they're creating Eve together. You know, we can look to perhaps other sources of thought about this. Now, again, I want to emphasize that's not in this book, that's in other stuff that I've done, in part because this book is really just trying to tell the history of how we got to where we are. And I became more and more convinced that we needed to understand that history as I was trying to think through the theology a little bit. But the history is really kind of the focus of this book. So if you're looking for that stuff in this book, you won't find it. But I'm happy to talk about it anyway.
So you've mentioned how the church has sort of shifted from a patriarchy to a heterosexual kind of teaching approach in which men and women are seen more as equal partners. Well, that kind of begs the question, can you foresee a time of even more change when same-sex marriages will, as you've mentioned, will be allowed in the church, if not sealed in the temple?
It's hard to predict. And one of the unfortunate things that historians have to do is we're stuck with the past, not unfortunately the future. We can't tell the future. However, I think that it's important to note, not only, as I do in the book, all of the numerous changes that the church has made on its teachings of gender and sexuality over the last 50 years. Not even, again, everybody always wants to point to polygamy as obviously this huge revolutionary change, and then the end of polygamy is another huge revolutionary change in our teachings of marriage. We're much closer than that. I mean, we're in the last couple of decades, in some cases, of major changes on gender and sexuality And so it certainly is possible to think of more changes coming, of course, because the church is always changing. On this particular issue, I think that the first step, as I've tried to lay out in this book, is really understanding our history, because so many people think that these doctrines have never changed and therefore never can, because there's no precedent for changing them. And that's just simply not true. Most of the doctrines that we have are my age, I'm in my 40s, my age or newer in most cases. And it doesn't seem that way because the changes often come slowly, they're iterative, you don't really notice them, you know. But to go back in the 1970s, I wouldn't recognize the church, you know, in most cases. You read the stuff that they're saying and you're like, wow, this is very different than anything that they would say today. And certainly in the 1950s, and they wouldn't recognize our church either. You know, the kinds of things that, you know, they would see a Mia Love and freak out, right? That would not be something that would be allowed in any world in the 1950s church. And so I think that as a historian, thinking about change as not only inevitable, but very much trying to tell the story of the changes that have happened over the time is part of the kind of first steps of this book. So whether or not it'll happen, that's not my job, of course, and it's beyond the scope, but it's not outside of the realm of possibility given the number of changes that we've had so far.
So you've seen you've tracked these changes that people would say were absolutely doctrinal, and you're saying, but doctrine changes. What doctrines are there that could support same-sex marriage? And what doctrines are there that would oppose it?
Yeah. Well, let me answer the first one, first, I guess. And again, just to say that this isn't the aspects of this book necessarily. So right. we're outside of it, but I'm happy to speculate about this stuff, because why not? Okay. I think that if we start to think of our doctrines of sealing people as a form of making kinship, that is, that we are bringing together people to form long-lasting, loving relationships of care, and the precedents for this go all the way back to early Mormonism, when we were sealing people in sexual and non-sexual relationships in all sorts of ways and trying to expand our networks of what we would consider kin. And so as long as we kind of stay with that core idea, that's what the core of what sealing is all about, I certainly think that there is space to open it up to all kinds of caring, loving, long-term relationships of all kinds of people, to establish those, to honor those, and to give the best that the church can give to those kinds of relationships, to support them and to sustain them and to give them the resources and the care that they need, as they do for so many other people and other kinds of relationships today. So I think that's one way of kind of expanding the scope of what we think about what counts as legitimate relationships. What are the obstacles to this? Well, of course, the current obstacle is that we have come to understand heterosexuality as the only legitimate form of relationship. And as Dave was mentioning, we look to Heavenly Mother as the sort of paradigm, Heavenly Father, Heavenly Mother relationship as the paradigmatic marriage that we all then need to imitate. But that's not the only relationship that exists in the heavens. It's not the only relationships that exist in the scriptures. It actually almost doesn't exist in the scriptures at all in the way that we've come to think about it. Mm-hmm. It really reflects these the sort of working from, we need to justify heterosexuality, therefore where do we go, rather than deriving it from our texts and traditions as they come to us, which show a huge variety of different kinds of relationships, even different kinds of reproductive relationships than the ones that we see. We see all sorts of relationships where the wife can't get pregnant with her husband in the scriptures, and so therefore there's some other form of reproductive technology that takes place. Even in the early in early polygamy, Brigham Young is practicing things like marrying for the purposes of reproduction, a wife to another man because her husband can't reproduce with her, and so then they have children, and that those children belong to the first husband. Right, so we're doing all these kinds of surrogacy that we have in our tradition and certainly in the scriptures as well, to point to other, even if we wanted to say reproduction is an important part of our tradition, we want to support it, there are all kinds of other things that we can look to as precedents for that.
So Patrick Mason has, of course, commented in your book about your book that the changes between the 1970s and today on LGBT issues in the church is, it's really quite rapid when you consider human history. And so has the study of this history, Taylor, made you feel hopeful about change in the church and the possibility of change?
That's a great question. I will say that that specific history, the sort of gay and lesbian history in the church and the ways that the church has talked about it, was really depressing for me to read. There were especially some really tough decades there where we're still, I think, dealing with the damage of those, that period too. And so I don't by any means want to underplay the significance of just how bad it was. And fortunately, the church has taken a lot of steps to kind of walk back and to reformulate and to reach out in new ways and to undo some of that damage. But I think for many people, it's certainly not enough yet either. We're still in this sort of liminal state, I think. And in a lot of ways, I think that the church is trying to decide how far it can go and how far it's willing to go. And maybe it's trying to wait out to see how this is going to play out culturally, because we could envision a situation where, like abortion, 40 years later, this is a socially divisive issue, right? Where some people think this and some people think that, and we all just kind of tolerate each other, right? And maybe that's how same-sex marriage is going to be, right? Or maybe same-sex marriage is going to be more like the civil rights and racism, and it's just not going to be tolerated. And there's no socially acceptable world in which a kind of racist status is going, or racist kind of teachings is going to be acceptable anymore. And maybe that's where we're going to go with same-sex marriage, and that there's just going to be a point where it's just not a socially sustainable position anymore. So I don't know how that's going to play out. And I don't know if the church knows how that's going to play out. And maybe it's waiting to see what it's going to do, which way things are going to break. But I certainly think that the broader social context that we live in has to influence our teachings, because it always has. It always has. Every teaching we've ever taught on same-sex relationships has been derived from a broader social context. And to think that that wouldn't be the case in the future is, would be an ahistorical position to take.
Well, the book again is Tabernacles of Clay, Sexuality and Gender in Modern Mormonism. Taylor Petrie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you both.
And stay safe, okay?
Thank you.
And thanks to Peggy Fletcher Stack.
Always a pleasure.
And to our producer, Chris Samuels. We remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to our free weekly newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next time on Mormonland.